The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Edgar Jatu, and I'm the president of the Black Law Student Association at American University Washington College of Law. And I want to thank you all for coming here tonight for this International Week event entitled Access to HIV/AIDS Medicine in the African and Caribbean Regions. Before I give the mic over to Sean, I want to thank the Program on Information Justice and Intellectual Property for helping to co-sponsor this event and to bring together the wonderful panelists we have here tonight. Part of the reason why BALSA decided to put this event together was because, as all of you may know, there is a tremendous epidemic in HIV/AIDS in the African and Caribbean regions. And we wanted to bring to light a lot of the trade barriers and policies that play a large part in how this epidemic is seen in the world. So without further ado, I want to give the floor to Sean Flynn and the panelists.
Great. Thank you all very much for coming. I'm the Associate Director of the Program on Information Justice and Intellectual Property, and we're co-hosting this program with the Black Law Students Association, and we're very happy to be here and very happy that all of you are here. I want to kick off. I'm really going to play the role of moderator tonight, but I wanted to give kind of a substantive introduction into the topic and kind of frame the issues for discussion with a few facts and figures, and then lead into introducing our panels and having an exchange between them. I just want to let you all know in advance that Chris Wilson, who we're very honored to have here today, needs to leave at about 7:15, so we're going to do our best to keep some space before that for questions and answers so we can make sure that we have enough time for him to participate in that. And that's both for the audience and our panelists, so if we can kind of keep each of the presentations to about 15 minutes, that should leave us enough time for half an hour or so of discussion before Chris has to leave. And then we're free to go a little bit, keep going a little bit after that if there's still discussion going on. So if necessary, Chris will just slip out and we can keep going. So it's not because he's being rude or doesn't like what's going on. Let me just start off with a few facts and figures that people may already know about, but just to kind of frame the discussion. The topic today is access to medicines in sub-Saharan Africa and the Caribbean particularly. And one of the reasons that that's such a hot issue in the access to medicines literature movement is because, at least in respect of AIDS, that's where the focus of the problem is. There's about 38.6 million people in the world with AIDS, and 24.7 of them live in Africa. It's the area of the world with the highest prevalence of the disease. And then part of the access problem, of course, is that it's also an area with an extremely low GDP per capita. Countries as a whole in that area of the region are very poor comparatively, and individuals within those countries are very poor comparatively as well. So you have the highest need for new AIDS drugs, but also economically the lowest capacity to access them. Now, the second part of the problem in this area is the effects of monopolies, the effects of patent rights on the pricing strategies of pharmaceutical firms. So this figure, this chart shows what has become quite common in the access to medicines movement and area, is a chart showing the decrease of prices over time with the introduction of competition. And one of the things I want to concentrate on is by way of introduction is that first bar graph showing that in 2000, which is the year before there was Indian producers and other producers in developing countries creating competition for the supply of AIDS drugs, the prices across the world were all pretty standard. Basically, the price in every country of the world was about $10,000 per person per year, no matter how rich or poor that country was. And if you compare that $10,000 per year figure with the average GDP per capita in sub-Saharan Africa of $743 in 2006, or in the Caribbean of $4,157 in 2006. You can perceive the problem of access gap. People's disposable income, in fact, people's total income, is nowhere near what would be required to access those medicines just based on the price. And the second function is that after competition was introduced and various suppliers came online, the price of those drugs went from $10,000 to, on this figure, below $300, and the current figure today is below $200 for a first-line regime of the same drugs. Now, in economic terms, the patent monopoly is a policy trade-off that we have to raise the price of patented items explicitly and purposefully in order to create incentives for innovation. And part of the discussion here is whether that's the right policy tool and what other policy tools exist for creating incentives to innovate in developing countries. So in this graph, the profit area, if you create a monopoly on a figure, this is a simple graph that just assumes the cost of producing and distributing a good was zero. So in a competitive market, the price of an item would be approximately zero, and the entire sum of that triangle would be consumer surplus. People would be purchasing an item for a price lower than they were expecting and willing to pay for it. When you create a monopoly, the profit-maximizing behavior of the firm will be to scale back production, serve a smaller segment of the market, and increase the price. And that transfers surplus from consumers to the producer in the form of profits, and also creates what's called deadweight loss, a number of people who will not be able to purchase that item who in a competitive market would have purchased it. And in medicine terms, the deadweight loss are people who don't have access to life-saving medicines. So the balance and the trade-off becomes quite stark. Now this is just a figure to show the effects of that kind of a system within a developing country. This is based on South Africa, so a highly unequal income distribution. And what that unequal income distribution produces is a very high trade-off between serving a very small segment of the market and serving the entire market. So this just assumes that everybody would purchase a medicine if it was the same percent of their income. And you can see if you assume that people would purchase that medicine at 5% of their income, then you could charge about $1,500 to the richest segment of the population. But then moving down and serving the next 10% of the population, you'd have to decrease your price to $400 and then half again the price to $200, et cetera, down the line. And what that means is under that monopoly system, if you assume that everybody that can afford the drug will buy it because it's an essential good, it creates a profit-maximizing system that forces the company to serve only the very highest income earners within that society. So this is just a graph of the revenue that would be earned by serving each decile within that population. And each time you scale up production and serve more people and lower your price in order to serve those more people, you end up making less and less money all the way down. And the incentives are very different in a country with much more equal income distribution. So this is taking the same assumptions as just applying it to Norway. And here, serving only the wealthiest 10% of the population becomes the least profitable action that monopoly holder can pursue. So their marginal revenue just keeps going up and up until you serve about 80% of the population. And then it starts going down only when they're serving the poorest. And if you assume that very large income inequalities exist in most developing countries, then the South Africa graph is going to be much more common than the Norway graph as a profit-maximizing behavior for those firms. And the trade-off between providing incentives to innovate through that monopoly versus the amount of people who will be excluded from the product becomes quite a stark and large trade-off. And that's basically the basics and the starting point for the discussion we're going to have today. And the question becomes, what is the proper trade-off between incentives to innovate and between access to necessary products like pharmaceuticals? What are the policy tools within the patent system that we can promote to make that balance more in line with our normative values? What are some of the alternatives that NGOs and others are thinking about in order to create incentives and have a better trade-off with access? And finally, what have students done in this area, and what can students continue to do to take part in these debates, and if you're so inclined, to participate in activism on one side or the other? So we have today an incredible panel to address these issues. First, we have Chris Wilson, who's the Deputy Assistant Secretary for the U.S. Trade Representative, and he's in the office that addresses pharmaceuticals and innovation. So he's really at the heart of U.S. policy on the incorporation of patent standards and free trade agreements, and the heart of the U.S. thinking about how to make this balance work. We have James Love, who's the head of Knowledge Ecology International and has been a longtime advocate for access to essential medicines in ways that continue to provide incentives to innovate. And he'll talk about some of those trade-offs and some of those the policies that NGOs are playing in this area. And finally, Matt Kavanaugh, who's the executive director of a group called Global Justice, which includes within it the Student Global AIDS Campaign, who's really been at the heart of where students have fallen into this and can tell us a little bit about how students have affected the debate and how they might continue in the future. So please help me welcome our panel, and we'll go right into it with Chris to begin with.
Good evening, everybody, and Sean, thank you very much for the invitation. And again, I apologize that I'm going to need to cut out perhaps a bit before the session has ended this evening. I think, the panel this evening is addressing an intersection of public policy issues in sort of several different baskets: intellectual property rights, trade policy, and public health and access to medicines. And I think it's fair to say that intersection of policy issues remains the subject of a very vigorous international debate and a very vigorous domestic debate. So I appreciate the opportunity to provide a perspective on that from somebody who's practicing as a practitioner of U.S. trade policy to present our perspective on how these various sets of issues fit together and how we're trying to approach them through U.S. trade policy. At the risk of beginning on perhaps a bit of a negative note, I think it's perhaps unfortunate that in the 10 years or so that this debate has really been underway, there, I think, has been a tendency in discussing this intersection of IP, trade policy, and access make the argument a bit too subject to sort of black and white analyses and lines of argumentation. There are those who argue, and with absolute conviction, the current system of global and national intellectual property rules, and particularly with respect to patents, is a core impediment, and perhaps the core impediment, to enabling greater and more equitable access to medicines domestically and internationally. There are also those who argue with an absolutely equal degree of conviction that any application of flexibility in intellectual property rules in order to promote greater access to medicines creates a slippery slope that will ultimately end up in destroying incentives to continue innovating in the development of medicines. I think this sort of the dichotomy that's often presented in this debate unfortunately often ends up losing a lot of nuance and detracting a lot of attention from many other very complex issues and factors surrounding the question of access to medicines. And I think it's meant that there has been too little focus in our public policy process and in the international debate on critical issues like healthcare delivery infrastructure in developing countries, unnecessary tariff and tax barriers that are often applied to drugs, obviously questions of basic poverty and the challenges that confronts to access, and constraints as well in the area of human resources that are important in providing health care. At any rate, These are the sort of the competing demands that those of us operating in the sphere of U.S. public policy are contending with in what has developed to be, I think, certainly one of the most challenging areas of U.S. trade policy. What we're trying to accomplish is to bring about legitimate balances between ultimately two sets of policy objectives. One, the creation of innovation in the production of new medicines through intellectual property, and second, meaningful public health responses, including through access to medicines in developing countries. A lot of people regard these two sets of objectives as being sort of in fundamental conflict. That's not the perspective of U.S. public policy. We regard them as being, in fact, complementary. But again, that's the subject of a lot of debate. There has been, over the course of recent years, a lot of criticism from organizations like those represented by my fellow panelists, members of Congress, and others, including, I would add, the U.S. pharmaceutical industry, indicating that we're not getting the balance right or that we continue to need to be looking for ways to adjust the balance in one direction or another. And some of you may be aware that a certain amount of that dynamic has played out in the context of some of our more recently negotiated free trade agreements and the intellectual property provisions that were negotiated in those agreements, and we can perhaps discuss that later in the evening. This sort of buffeting between these sort of competing visions goes with the territory of being part of the public policy process. But we're continuing to work hard and with a genuine commitment to achieving this balance. And what I'm hoping to do this evening briefly is just to give you a very brief and probably quite broad overview of how U.S. trade policy is approaching these issues and the key elements that we're focusing on in trying to strike this balance. I think, as probably most people here are aware, the U.S. government and not just the current administration has had a very long-standing policy conviction that encouraging high levels of intellectual property protection domestically and internationally is good and intelligent policy for the United States. Our economy here in the United States increasingly competes on the basis of ideas and knowledge and the products that flow from that knowledge. And so protecting that knowledge through strong systems of intellectual property is an important part of what U.S. international economic policy and U.S. trade policy has sought to achieve. The leading role that the United States played 10, 12, 15 years ago in the development of the TRIPS agreement at the WTO and our subsequent efforts to negotiate high standards of IP protection and enforcement through our bilateral free trade agreements are obviously a reflection of these long-standing policy convictions. It's also our conviction, going back to a point that I opened with, that strong IP protection is compatible with good public health policy, including policies that promote greater access to medicines. Our policy proceeds from a conviction that access can't only be about access to existing drugs, although obviously that's a very critical piece of the issues that are being addressed this evening. Access is also about enabling the creation of drugs that will improve upon existing treatments and that will hopefully produce cures to diseases that aren't currently curable. I think one point that's often overlooked in this dichotomy that is often drawn between the tension between innovative patent-protected drugs and generic medicines is that without a process to create and ensure the creation of new and innovative drugs, generic producers will lack a steady stream of new products to bring to the market, including in developing countries. And so this is part of the context in which U.S. policy is taking place and in which we will continue to defend strong systems of IP in terms of helping to produce the kind of innovation that can produce that broader sense of what access is about. There's also another element in which we believe that strong IP systems can and do contribute to expanded access for existing innovative drugs. And that is that a country that maintains strong levels of protection for patents and other forms of intellectual property is, we believe, more likely to benefit from decisions of pharmaceutical companies to actually place those products in the market of that country. That obviously doesn't resolve all issues surrounding access, and there are many issues in the area of pricing that are very current in that respect. But I think we do feel that the existence of strong IP protections provides a very important incentive for the placement on the market of life-saving drugs. So again, I think from our perspective, it's important to recognize that strong intellectual property and effective access aren't incompatible concepts and are, in fact, and can be complementary. But, and here we get to the other side of the balance equation, that doesn't mean that we're unable to recognize that effective access to medicines, particularly with respect to the challenges confronting developing countries in Africa, the Caribbean, and elsewhere, and with respect to major global pandemics like HIV/AIDS, that this also entails a respect for the flexibilities that exist within the global system and national rules governing intellectual property protection. And so I want to just, again, briefly touch on a few ways in which we've sought to work this side of the balance equation into our trade policy. Most of you may be familiar with a very important declaration that was concluded by members of the WTO about 6 years ago, the Doha Declaration on the TRIPS Agreement and Public Health. That declaration arose from a lot of concerns of developing countries, particularly in Africa, that the TRIPS Agreement, the system within the WTO of IP rules, might inhibit or impede access to medicines. And so there was a very active and a lengthy debate in the WTO that led to the conclusion of this declaration at Doha in 2001, which does a number of things. It refers to the importance of IP as a fundamental factor in promoting innovation, but it also refers to the importance of the flexibilities that are built into the TRIPS agreement and that can be used to address public health, urgent public health circumstances, and in particular the intellectual property mechanisms that are specifically mentioned in the declaration are the compulsory licensing of patents and the use of parallel importation. The U.S. is very strongly committed to the Doha Declaration and to reflecting its principles in the way that we conduct our trade policy. The Doha Declaration had an element that launched a special negotiation that was intended to essentially fix an obstacle that had currently existed in the TRIPS agreement that impeded countries from exporting drugs under a compulsory license in order to help meet the public health needs of other countries. There was a negotiation that led to a solution that eventually will be embodied as an amendment to the TRIPS agreement that accomplished that objective. We're now seeing WTO members beginning to put that solution into place. One LDC member of the WTO has recently initiated a process to use that mechanism, and that is something that we very much welcome. Turning from sort of the multilateral angle at the WTO to our how all of this sort of enters into the picture in terms of our bilateral trade policy, we have in the United States over the last 6 years or so had a very active program of negotiating bilateral free trade agreements with countries in this hemisphere, with a number of countries in North Africa and the Middle East, most of them developing countries. I think there's been a certain amount of misperception of those agreements and how they intersect with this issue of IP and access to medicines. We've taken care to ensure that the flexibilities that are addressed in the Doha Declaration are fully reflected in our free trade agreements. And so it's the case that in the context of the FTAs that we've negotiated with developing countries, none of those agreements impose any constraints on the ability of our FTA partners to employ compulsory licensing or to employ parallel imports. There's one exception with respect to parallel importation in the case of a trading partner that had previously had in its own laws some restrictions on parallel importation and wanted to preserve those, and so that is reflected in our FTA with that particular country. Otherwise, again, our agreements impose no restrictions on the use of those flexibilities with respect to public health or any other matter. There's also, within the context of our free trade agreements, an explicit recognition through an understanding on public health that the obligations that we've negotiated on intellectual property rights in those free trade agreements do not and should not prevent a party to those agreements from taking measures to protect public health by promoting access to medicines for all. And those understandings have actually now been embodied as formal elements in the intellectual property chapters in the context of the most recent free trade agreements that we've negotiated. Beyond free trade agreements, these issues also occasionally arise in the context of our bilateral trade policy relations with countries around the world. There's been a lot of attention in the past year to the use of compulsory licensing by a couple of members of the WTO. Thailand has received a particular amount of attention. Brazil also, in the spring of this year, issued a compulsory license on an HIV/AIDS medication. We've worked hard to try to ensure that our policy responses to these applications of IP flexibilities are balanced. We have expressed concerns, particularly in the Thailand case, about issues related to transparency and due process, and about the potential impact of a widespread application of compulsory licensing on an innovation climate and access considerations in the concerned countries. But we've also taken care not to rush to judgments about the compatibility of these actions with the rules of the WTO embodied in the TRIPS agreement. And we've also taken care in terms of how we've expressed ourselves on these issues through our bilateral contacts with these countries. I know there's been some attention to the fact, just to take a quick step back, USTR has, under a statutory obligation, an obligation every year to produce a report on the adequate and effective protection of intellectual property among U.S. trading partners around the world. This year, Thailand was moved from one watch list to another watch list under our, we call this the Special 301 provision, indicating a higher degree of U.S. government concerns about the overall intellectual property climate in Thailand. It received a lot of attention in light of the fact that Thailand had recently implemented policies with respect to compulsory licensing. But I think it's important to point out that, in fact, that decision was the result of a very broad range of factors and concerns about the intellectual property climate in Thailand, reflecting the views of a wide range of U.S. industries, copyright, trademark holders, and others who were expressing a view that the level of protection for intellectual property in Thailand had degraded over the course of the past year. I would also point out that because I think that there is a tendency to draw very direct connections between these medicines-related flexibilities and the 301 report, that with respect to Brazil, which had also implemented a compulsory licensing this year, the decision that we made on Brazil was actually to improve their position on our watch list as a result of some steps that Brazil had taken in the past year to improve the general level of enforcement of intellectual property rights. I'm out of time. Let me just conclude by saying, and I think this is something that Jamie will be focusing on. As I mentioned at the outset, this is a very complex intersection of issues that in many ways remains quite unresolved, and there are obviously going to be a lot more debates ahead on this. I think what we're seeing currently is a certain migration of focus on these issues from the World Trade Organization, where they were addressed for a period of 10 years or so, to other institutions, and in particular to the World Health Organization, where there will be a lot of attention to these issues coming up later this year and perhaps beyond that. I think the perspective of the U.S. government on this is that it's important to keep these discussions as pragmatic as possible, and we certainly as a government are committed to that. I think that if we get into sort of black and white arguments about whether the current system of IP should be extensively dismantled, that will drive a lot of people into their corners, and it won't really get us very far in terms of resolving a lot of the very important issues of access that remain unresolved and need to be addressed. And I think it's important as we move into these new settings and new environments for discussing these issues to keep a focus on issues in addition to IP that are very, very critically important, analyzing research and development gaps, analyzing problems with healthcare delivery infrastructure, looking at issues of human resources in the field of healthcare, looking at unnecessary tariffs and taxes that are applied to drugs. So we hope we can take a very broad approach to all of these issues as we carry the international debate forward. Again, I know this has been a very broad overview, but hopefully it will provide some good grist for the discussion. So thank you very much.
Are you mostly from, not everyone, I know some people are not from here, but are most people here from the law school? I know Josh in the back from the law school. My name is Jamie Love. I work for a group we used to be called Consumer Project on Technology. I guess we still can be called that, but we've created a new entity that has a new name called Knowledge Ecology International, or KEI. And with us, I mean, there's two people that used to work with us, Sean and Michael Palmedo. For many years, Michael was probably the best known member of our staff, I think, and is responsible for the great research resources on the CP Tech webpage that he has done by far and away more work than anyone else, and has probably helped more students who do work in this area than anybody I know. With me today is Judith Rios, who's a lawyer, just came to us from Stanford, and is also worked for EFF and Oxfam and a pharmaceutical company, and is now working with us. She's taken over actually the position that Sean used to occupy. She's actually recommended by Sean, so Sean talked me into it. So. And Molly Asola, who used to look after psychopaths in a prison in Madison, Wisconsin, before we got her to come to work for us. So that's our team. And Judith has some of these. This is a bumper sticker we have called, it says, you probably can't read it, it says I plus A, Innovation plus Access. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But if you want a sticker for your computer or something, let us know. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about Chris Wilson's presentation, if it's okay. And because I guess that's part of what you expect me to do, right? You probably said some very provocative things, so I would take the opposite position. So I'll try and do that a little bit. But I will start out with a compliment to say I was quite impressed that the USTR reached an agreement with Congressman Rangel and Congressman Levine in the House, in this House, White House agreement about compromising and rolling back some of the provisions in the free trade agreements in some countries having to do with patent extensions, data exclusivity, and linkage of between patents and drug registration, which we had and other groups had identified as the three most important areas that they were concerned about, the provisions in how the free trade agreements could harm access to medicine. And so I thought this was really impressive in the current political environment, and I assume that part of the reason for that has been that many of the staff people in the United States Trade Representative at the civil servant level and at other levels have been generally reluctant to go too far in the opposite direction as it relates to access to medicine as compared to, say, how bad things were in, like, 1999, for example, in the bad old days. So I would just like to share that because I'll probably say some critical things and I maybe start with that, though, more positive. Now, in terms of Thailand, the idea that Thailand would be criticized for transparency is quite astonishing to me. They have a 108-page white paper explaining what they did on the compulsory licenses. I don't know any country that's put out a 108-page white paper explaining what they did on a compulsory license. And we look at compulsory licenses all the time. They've done meetings with U.S. government officials. They've held briefings in Geneva. They've held briefings in Capitol Hill. They've held press conferences after press conferences after press conferences. And I would posit that with all the compulsory licenses that have been issued, including the three that have been issued in Italy in the last couple of years on drugs, including one for male pattern baldness, and the several compulsory licenses of other countries in the regions, that the very reason why Thailand was really has received all these demarches from the U.S. Embassy and has been put on the elevated to the 301 list is precisely because they have been very transparent. I mean, Thailand is basically telling the whole world what they did, how they did it, why they did it, and everything like that. And that's attracted a lot of attention from the drug companies because they don't want other companies to follow the example that Thailand did. If Thailand, like lots of other countries, had issued a compulsory license and put it in the bottom drawer and not held a press conference, I don't really think they would have received as much attention as they have from U.S. government officials or from the drug companies. It's more the proselytizing role of what Thailand's done and the complete transparency which has created the problems. The only thing that changed in Thailand on their IP thing is really that changed was really the fact that they issued these compulsory licenses. And it's really a shame that Thailand hadn't acted earlier to grant compulsory licenses. Thailand is a situation like, just as it relates to AIDS, there's no way that Thailand can sustain treatment for AIDS patients or can give good treatment for people that have AIDS if it doesn't have access to low-cost second-generation AIDS drugs. And I think one government that can really sympathize with what Thailand was struggling for is the United States government, because the United States government is now the largest funder of AIDS drugs in developing world right now. And we were, with other governments, but led by the United States, really, committed to putting over 3 million people on treatment in developing countries on drugs that they were buying initially for close to $150 to $100 per year, faced with second-generation drugs that you're going to need that are priced, in some cases, at thousands of dollars per year. You can't take people and start them on cocktails at $150 a year and put 3 million of them on cocktails and then try and move them to drugs that cost over $1,000, in some cases over $2,000 for cocktails, and make it work. The U.S. has committed $6 billion a year for the PEPFAR program. Maybe USDR can tell the Congress how it can get the money to keep those people on treatment at new prices unless compulsory licenses are issued. I don't know that the people at USDR talk to the people at OMB enough or the people in the Finance Committee, but there's no way we can pay for millions of people in developing countries to save their life, what's essentially a humanitarian market, unless we get access to cheap second-generation drugs. Now, the first-generation drugs were okay when they were first using them, but people know now that the cocktail that most people in developing countries is toxic, it has all kinds of problems, and it should be replaced with the other drugs. And even under the best of circumstances, every patient is going to face resistance at some point and have to move to a new product. So the U.S. is kind of in a dilemma. They actually are more of a consumer of AIDS drugs in developing countries than Thailand or Brazil is at this point. So they have to find a way to get access to cheap drugs. But they also, as Chris mentioned, they need access to the pipeline. You need access to the new drugs. And so this is really an interesting problem. How do you actually reconcile the fact that you want people and you want to save as many lives as possible and you don't want to be paying $2,000 for a drug that costs $50 to make? What you want to do in a place where the difference between access and no access is life and death, what you want to do in those circumstances is find a way, a new business model, if you will. You want to find a way to think about how do you actually keep the pipeline going without killing people? How do you basically do that? How do you manage that? Now, that's one of the things that is being discussed right now in a negotiation that's taking place with the World Health Organization. There's been a debate in Geneva and elsewhere about whether or not the current system of intellectual property protection for medicine, the current way we pay for R&D, the current way we think about coming up with the money to pay for the next new drug, is the right way to think about the problem, given the fact that companies, as Sean pointed out in the slides, in developing countries often price their drugs so that only the top 5% or best top 20% of the population are going to have access to the drugs. Can we really tolerate a world where 80% or 90% of the people in the developing world and the vast majority of the people who live on this earth are deliberately priced out of market for medicines because that's the only way we can imagine to support a new drug development in terms of the private incentives? And I think the answer has to be no. It has to be that young people, that people that are thinking about these problems, that people go to all these economic classes and business schools and things like that, can figure out a way to raise money that doesn't involve that kind of exclusion and those kind of morally repugnant policies in terms of access, but does actually address the bona fide legitimate needs of the biomedical sector to get a payday and to have some way basically to get a reward for their investments. Now, we know as a general idea about what the trade framework is like, that there's a very well-defined, complex, and powerful international trade framework that deals with intellectual property rights. How many people here have heard of the TRIPS agreement? Okay, well, TRIPS agreement, WTO, it's got an agreement that deals with the patents, the policies you have to do, and obligations in country to support patents on medicines. There's also other treaties that are administered by this UN agency, WIPO, that deals with intellectual property that has obligations on that. There's bilateral agreements that Chris talked about. There's a lot of complicated things like that. The R&D process involves a combination of what you have in terms of private incentives to do new drug development on the one hand and what you have in the public sector. That's sort of one idea that you have. Everyone here has heard of the NIH, right? We spend $30 billion a year on public sector, open source type research. Dr. Fauci from the NIH often goes to these meetings of the G8 and things, and he asks other countries to contribute to the cost of doing open source research on malaria vaccines and things like that. There's a lot of problems and challenges in the area of getting governments to pony up and pay for the cost of doing public sector research and participate in those projects. There's also new thinking about the way that you finance and that you stimulate private sector investment. And the area that we've been focusing on the most is the idea that you can use prize-type incentives as opposed to monopolies as a reward for drug development. Well, what does that mean? That means that if you invest money and you're a successful developer of a drug nowadays, the reward you get, the private sector reward you get, is the government grants you a monopoly, but you know, protected by patents and other types of intellectual property. That allows you to do what? That allows you to charge really high prices during the period of the monopoly, and then after that monopoly is over, because it's a temporary monopoly, then it becomes a generic drug. Well, we don't love monopolies, but we think that that's a way to get money to the drug developers. They use the monopoly to make, you know, profits from the high prices, and that's how they pay back their R&D cost. But that's not the only way you can reward the developer of a new drug. You could, for example, say that we'll just give you money if you're a successful developer. And that's what people are proposing. And a growing number of experts, economists like Joe Stiglitz, Aidan Hollis from Canada, academics like Thomas Pogge, our group, Tim Hubbard from the Wellcome Trust, members of Congress, like Senator Bernie Sanders, are saying we should think about the idea of using prizes as the incentive for drug development instead of monopolies. That, you know, you can create essentially a culture of abundance in terms of access to innovation, but still have a thriving economy. What's a good example you can think about that represents a change in the business model? Well, the Internet. You all are so young, you can probably not remember when people didn't use Internet on a daily basis. But back in the old days, we used to think a telecommunications network is where every time you used something for a minute, it cost you money. Everything was metered on the margin. It was expensive to do anything that involved a telephone. When the Internet came about, what was the sort of new business model? Well, you paid some money to amortize the cost of the network, you know, like a monthly fee. But if you sent an email, it was free. If you downloaded a web page, you didn't pay anything for that. So on the margin, the Internet became kind of free, even though it wasn't free completely, because you had to pay money to, you know, to get access at some point. Well, this change in the way that you thought about pricing Internet services led to what? It led to an absolute culture of abundance of information goods on the Internet. It totally radically transferred the world to the fact that nobody would imagine going back to the old system. That's what we're proposing, and that's what other people are proposing for medicine, to change the business model so that you pay for the drugs, but not through a high tariff of $1,000 on what basically you could manufacture like for aspirin to give to somebody who's dying to say that's how we're paying for our R&Ds. We're having a 25,000% markup on this drug. So under those circumstances, what you try and do is essentially find a way that you can actually reconcile the need to have an incentive with the idea that you need to have access. Now, I'll finish now because I'm getting the time signal from Sean to say that within this process at the WA, this current negotiation, it's a serious negotiation. There's a resolution passed at WHO that the U.S. abstained from. But they're in the final stretch right now for a negotiation that takes place in November. At that time, at that moment, what we're hoping the U.S. will do is to sort of find a way to think about not just, you know, like saying we want to have balance between, you know, how many people die versus how many people, new drugs we get, but actually think about doing something better than doing a trade-off between innovation and access, but to try and actually reconcile the need to have both innovation and access at the same time, not to make compromises on access, but also not to make compromises on the need to have innovation. And it's a complicated idea, and I can't say anything more about it right now, or Sean will turn off the microphone, but thank you very much.
Sean's pretty scary. So I'm going to try to just talk briefly and watch the time so we do get some time to have conversation here. But my name is Matt Kavanaugh, as Sean was saying, and I run an organization called Global Justice that houses a number of different student and youth-led campaigns that are focused on trying to transform the way the United States does public policy through doing grassroots organizing here in the United States to make sure that the people that are making decisions here in the United States, which have massive implications, right, for people living around the world, are actually held accountable for what those implications are, right? That potholes aren't maybe always the most important thing to worry about, right? But who's yelling, who's screaming, who's making the most noise is the people that get the attention, right? So our goal here is to make sure that those who have less power to influence the United States government are actually standing in solidarity with people who do have a lot of power, those of us sitting in this room for a variety of reasons, right? Especially people who are about to be lawyers in the United States would have a little bit of power, perhaps. So given that supposition, we've been very active in trying to push for a number of different things. And the baseline of what we're looking at, right, is that as people campaigning on global AIDS, we're not so interested in the deep kind of like what are the conversations and what are the various deep intricacies that we sometimes get sucked into. What we're most interested in is what's going to get more drugs into bodies. Because that's what's actually going to make the difference between life and death, right? Drugs get into bodies. And so sometimes we get lost in the minutiae of these things, and we don't ask the question, what's going to get drugs into bodies? And so our supposition at the start of this is that the United States government could be pushing for policies that would get more drugs into bodies, Or we could be arguing about how badly the policies that are being pushed are going to hurt drugs into bodies. And that ends up sometimes where we're at. So I do want to thank Chris for coming, right? Because I think this is one of those things that too often doesn't happen, right? Is we don't kind of have these public exchanges, discussions, and civil discussions, right? About what are the options out there, right? What are the models that in whatever level of democracy we have in the United States, right? Whatever that is, that we be really sure that the kind of conversations that are happening happen in public, right? So this is really nice to see, and we appreciate that. Couple quick things to say, then, given that base. One is that this is, in fact, and I hope everybody that's about to be a lawyer is paying attention, right? That this is, in fact, the next piece when it comes to struggles over who's going to kind of have access to wealth in the world, right? That increasingly, it no longer is about who owns the widget. And in fact, it's no longer even about who owns the factory that makes the widget. It's about who owns the idea of the widget. Because increasingly, that's the question in the world. And increasingly, access to power is based on that. But sometimes it's a little different when the widget is something that can keep you alive, right? And that is the base of our kind of conversation here, is the question of if the widget is going to keep somebody alive or let them die, then the question of who owns it becomes a lot different. You heard a couple of people talk about this kind of question of monopolies. And especially as we talk about second-line therapy, Jamie, I think, did a good job of talking about the fact that the old AIDS drugs, right, don't work increasingly for people. So that one of the things we often hear is that this, you know, the new policies that are being pushed aren't going to hurt anybody's access to old drugs. And that's generally true, right? But the new drugs as they come onto the market are increasingly what people need, right? And they are increasingly what people won't have access to. Right? That's our struggle. And so our supposition here is that if there are going to be monopolies, especially monopolies in wealthy countries, with those have to come deep responsibilities. Right? And that if this is the system that's going to be set up in the United States, with that should come a really clear responsibility to do a number of things. Right? Number one, in our opinion, should be that with that responsibility, with that comes a responsibility to make sure that people have access to those drugs who can't afford them. And this is, in fact, the bottom line question. And that's not, in fact, what's actually being discussed. We've got a number of different kind of arguments that are made out there, and one of them really is about this research and development question, right? And I want to make sure that we keep in mind that the kind of discussion that happens is often, uh-oh, we don't have enough money for research and development. And that's not quite accurate. In fact, it's not even a little bit accurate, right? Because there's a lot of money that's going into research and development, and much of it is public, right? You heard Jamie talk about the NIH and the amount of money that, you know, is spent at the NIH. That's actually public money that is going into the development of many of these drugs. And so understanding that with that should come the responsibility, if we're investing U.S. public money, then with that, what's the responsibility there, right? Is it just profit? The second piece to just note is that drug companies make a lot of money, right? And so drug companies on average make 3 times what they invested in research and development in profit. So this is not some sort of crazy broken system that we totally can't figure out where to make any money on making drugs, right? The vast majority of that gets made in wealthy nations. And so one of the topic of this tonight is about Africa and the Caribbean. Anybody know what percent of profit of drug companies maybe gets made in Africa? Any guess? Guess? Y'all are very quiet. No guesses? 10
million? 10,
what percent?
Oh,
0.4%, right? So this is pretty important to understand, right, is that the vast majority of people, a vast majority of profits are being made in wealthy nations. And so this kind of argument that therefore we have to make every single penny in the global south is a little bit problematic. The question then, if that's true, the question then becomes what's going on right now, right? And I'll start from the premise that we actually don't think that the setup that the World Trade Organization has gotten to makes a whole lot of sense, right? That actually WTO, you know, I am going to actually kind of do some black and white pieces and say that actually we don't think that the balance that we've struck right now does make a lot of sense. But even given that, right? Even given if we say the World Trade Organization policies aren't promoting more drugs into bodies, right? Even given that, what we're seeing increasingly is the really problematic move by the U.S. government to push above and beyond that. And that's where right now our struggle is, right? Because actually the world has come to a bit of a consensus, right, around, at least at this point, the TRIPS negotiations that have come to the Doha Declaration, which said that we need to make sure that all of these intellectual property desires and outcomes are in fact balanced based on the idea of access to medicines for all. Not access to medicines for some, but for all. And with that comes a whole bunch of policies. And so a couple of things that are going on right now that we know, right? One is that recently, and I'm going to talk about a couple of kind of victories, actually, that recently one of the things that was going on, right, was negotiations with the Southern African Customs Union. South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, Lesotho, and Swaziland. I think there were only five. Countries that actually are the epicenter of the global pandemic of HIV and AIDS, right? And these are negotiations that we know included a couple of things, right? They did include limits on compulsory licenses. Because what it said is that data, this thing called data exclusivity, right? Anybody know what data exclusivity means? One person, two people, three people? The basic idea being that if you want to register a drug in a country, you need to prove that that drug is safe and effective, and you need to give the country, the FDA, right, in whatever country you're trying to register it, you're trying to give them the information that shows this drug is safe and effective. Data exclusivity says that actually you can't use the information that was submitted by the old drug company, the original drug company, if you're a generic company. Meaning that you would have to repeat all of the clinical trials that the original company submitted in order to get your drug registered. The way it usually works is if you're a generic maker, you come in and you say, look, the original drug company has already given you all of the things to prove that this is a safe and effective drug. I'm just giving you the exact same drug, and it's a generic drug, right? So the U.S., we know, has been pushing for this data exclusivity concept, which means that for 5 years, generics aren't allowed to come in, right? And this is, in fact, restrictions on the idea of universal access to drugs. The other piece that we know is going on, right, and the other piece to say is that we would argue that that violates a whole bunch of kind of, you know, U.S. executive orders, et cetera, et cetera. The other piece is this Thailand piece, and I think Jamie did a really good job of talking about that, and I'm going to skip that, except to say that, you know, one of the things is that it matters. Paying attention to the details here matters, because the ability of Thailand, the Thai government, to issue a compulsory license, to make sure that all of the drugs that are going to be purchased will not bankrupt, right, the public health system, that ability is premised on the idea, in fact, that there's not going to be huge pressure from the United States. And subtle things in U.S. trade policy matters, right? So the elevation, in fact, in Thailand from the watch list to the priority watch list was big news in Thailand. And it, in fact, was used by a lot of people to say we should not have issued this compulsory license, and huge pressure was put to say we shouldn't issue any more. And that was because of that elevation. So to kind of imply that that's not having an effect is actually really clear, and it was really clearly interpreted in Thailand. And then there's a bunch of other ongoing negotiations, especially in Africa with a variety of different, you know, countries around these things called TICAs and TIFAs, and we're not really sure what's going on and what they are. But what we know is that there's been a push to not expand access, not expand the number of drugs into bodies, but actually decrease that, right, and to put up barriers that are real. And to say that they're not real isn't so true. The other piece to just say, then, is what does another model look like, right? What could the United States government be doing, right? And that question is, in fact, I think the bigger question, not how far would this restrict access to medicines, but what could the United States government be doing? Jamie talked about a couple of the things that the U.S. government could be doing, and hopefully we can talk about some of them. One of the other pieces that these guys love and I think are really smart is this idea of patent pools, right? What are the obligations that should come with the ability to have a monopoly over making a drug in wealthy countries? Well, perhaps that should be that you need to put your patent for that into a pool and make sure that everybody in developing countries have access to that, right? Generics are what's going to make the difference about whether or not somebody can access this or not, because generics always bring down the price of it throughout the extent of the life of it. Real quickly, three quick things. Young people and students have historically made a huge difference when it comes to changing what U.S. policy is. And I think it's really important to remember that this is, in fact, you know, U.S. policy that's being dictated by elected officials, right? So if we don't like what people are doing, or if we have questions about it, then it is our job to, in fact, say, this is not too complex, this is not too, you know, too hard to get into. We want to see a world in which the United States government is pushing increased access, not decreased access. There's a really quick story, which is to say that in 1999, okay, I'll stop in just a minute. In 1999, there was this guy named Al Gore. Anybody remember him? He was a good guy. He kind of was running for president at the time. He was the vice president, and he was actually responsible for a commission that was about bilateral trade with Southern Africa. And one of the things that was happening in 1999 is that a bunch of drug companies were actually suing South Africa, not because South Africa was actually going to make generic drugs, but because they were putting in legislation that might possibly allow them at some point to think about, possibly someday, thinking about making generic drugs to make sure that people didn't die of AIDS. Drug companies sued South Africa, and the United States Trade Representative, we know, actually added to that pressure, right? And Al Gore, it turned out, was in fact chair of the committee that was actually putting pressure, threatening sanctions against Southern Africa, just for thinking about making generic drugs. Well, a bunch of AIDS activists actually went and showed up at this little place called Carthage, Tennessee. Carthage, Tennessee was actually where Al Gore launched his campaign for president, right? And they were there, and all they did was they just stood up and held some signs that said AIDS drugs for Africa. And they went to the next stop where he was going to be in New York, and they held up signs that said AIDS drugs for Africa. And they went to the next stop in New Hampshire, where they held up signs that said AIDS drugs for Africa. And then all of a sudden, the first issue in the 2000 campaign, right, was in fact, why is Al Gore keeping people from having AIDS drugs in Africa? And all of a sudden, that became an issue. And shortly thereafter, the Clinton administration adopted an executive order saying that the United States Trade Representative was not allowed to use the power of the U.S. government to do anything that would restrict access to AIDS drugs in Africa. This is, in fact, a handful of people that made this happen. So thinking about what we can do right here, a small number of people can, in fact, change the course of U.S. policy. And right now, there's a number of things that we need. We need people to be doing that thing. We need people to be talking to Congress. We need people to be, you know, out in the streets. But we also need people to be sitting and thinking and making good law. So I would encourage all of you to think about kind of what is the thing that you can do, and if you don't know, then ask and I'll suggest some things. Thank you.
Great. So thank everybody for the presentations. And so we just have a few minutes left, especially with Chris. So I want to open it up for any discussions and questions, and especially if anybody has anything for USTR. Yeah.
My name is Michael. I have three questions, or maybe they're more comments. I was hoping Sean could help us out with this. Not to sound pessimistic, but I think there are three areas that weren't talked about. Maybe the economic area was talked about. For political, let's be honest, how many lobbyists are there for the pharmaceutical companies fighting this battle compared to people like you? I mean, it's just pretty lopsided who's really interested, whose interests are represented, first of all. I mean, how much money do they, for the economic reason, you talked a little bit about the research and development, but it's pretty staggering to realize how much they spend on marketing compared to research and development. And there's really not an economic incentive for them to supply 30 million people with drugs who can't afford it. As you said, the U.S. government has been buying a lot of those drugs. So you can also look at it as maybe Bush wasn't so generous making that $9 billion extra dollars for AIDS drugs if you got some support from some drug manufacturers who are getting all that money. Also, for the social reason, I don't think necessarily this is the answer, to be honest. Unfortunately, these problems need to be worked on, but supplying the drugs isn't going to solve the problem. A lot of this has to do, I think 20% of Bush's plan went towards prevention. I know that's maybe out of the scope of this conversation, but if you really want to fight the AIDS epidemic, treating people on a day-to-day basis with drugs that they can't even take, you're talking about the health infrastructure. They don't have the infrastructure to take these drugs on a regimented basis. They don't know what drugs to take when, and that's a few extra billion dollars. If you really want to fight this, you need education programs. I was hoping maybe you could address the first two points, though, on the political pressures and on the economic pressures. And how maybe the U.S. government could create some policies to fight those.
Well, we all operate within a political environment, obviously, and we're, you know, subject to, you know, a number of pressures within the public policy process. and positive influences, I might add as well. I mean, we do hear frequently from the pharmaceutical industry. It's an important constituent of ours. They produce important products. They create this innovation. And so we listen to them. They're not the only ones we listen to. And we take their input along with input from other organizations, from the generic industry, from others, and filter all of that through a process of trying to strike this really complicated balance that I was talking about, involving several different sort of pieces of the U.S. policy process on the economic side, the trade policy, intellectual property, and a public health perspective. I would just say, you know, at the risk of being perceived to sort of be leaping to the defense, I'd like to go back to that first graph that Sean showed us, which was this enormous drop-off in prices after 2000. And I think certainly a certain amount of that is due to the entry of greater generic competition in many markets. But I think that many U.S. companies do deserve a bit of credit for taking some steps on their own initiative to supply important drugs at cost or for free in many countries in Africa in particular. I think that's something that needs to be acknowledged. Again, there's a lot of criticism. There's a lot of defense that can be made with respect to any industry that we deal with. But I do think it's important to point out that industry has taken some important steps to address access issues through the pricing structures that they've adopted, particularly in Africa. And I think coming to some of the points that Jamie and Sean have made about the challenges surrounding second-line drugs, I just think we need to be very careful. And I think we need to think that a lot of the challenges surrounding pricing in the first line of antiretroviral treatments, those were largely resolved without overturning the current system of IP protection. So I think we need to be very careful about thinking about the legitimate challenges that do exist with respect to pricing and cost of second-line treatments, and to consider whether those challenges can also be addressed short of sort of upending the current system that, in our view, contributes to important innovation. I don't know, honestly.
Can I just take any other questions for Chris just before he leaves, because he's going to have to leave any second. Does anybody else have something? And then if we can just take any last questions, and then maybe Chris can address them quickly before he steps out.
I was curious. I know that you hear a lot from the pharmaceutical companies in relation to when policy is made and things like that. In relation to the Southern African development area and the Caribbean, how much input comes from those grassroots areas? Is there any input from the countries themselves or from organizations that are working in those countries when it comes to policy, and how is that weighed against what the pharmaceutical companies are giving or are saying?
Do you want to be very quick?
Very quick question. I was just wondering, after listening to Jamie and Matt speak, what your reactions might be to some of the alternate mechanisms suggested for incentivizing research and development, things such as patent pools and prize funds.
Well, to the first question, I mean, we do obviously have dialogues established with many, if not most, countries in sub-Saharan Africa and the Caribbean. I have to tell you that with respect to sub-Saharan Africa, because many of those countries are LDCs and are still, frankly, in a transition period in terms of implementing many of the international rules that are embodied in the TRIPS agreement, intellectual property isn't always a terribly prominent focus of their concerns or of our dialogue with those countries. But to the extent that issues are raised with respect to the sort of intersection between IP, trade policy, and public health, we take all of that into account. But again, because of the transition periods that exist within many of those countries, it's not perhaps as prominent as with respect to some other areas of trade policy. There's not a lot that I can really say in connection with some of the alternative suggestions that have been made, although Jamie's given me some paper tonight, which will obviously, be reading with interest. A couple of very off-the-cuff reactions, and I'm not enough of an IP technician in a lot of these areas to make terribly informed judgments. I think with respect to prizes, there are a lot of questions, I think, around sort of basic issues of sustainability that I think are important to really dig into and address. We have a model that exists now sort of based upon an IP system that has continued over time to produce new generations, new therapies. I think if we start looking at alternatives like sort of the prize model, we do need to think about what that relies upon in terms of public funding. Will that be sustainable over time? Are there ways to ensure that money is directed in ways that make sense in terms of disease burden and so forth? So I think just a lot of questions that exist with respect to that concept. And then I think with patent pools, which is something that I probably understand even less, I think we've seen that there's some utility to that concept in certain areas of technology where there may be multiple patents involved in a particular product. And so I think there are questions about the applicability of that to a drug, which is most often the subject of a single patent. So some very off-the-top-of-the-cuff reactions there.
So we should let Chris escape, but we're going to give the rest of our panel an opportunity to respond, either with you here or in absentia, but feel free to leave whenever you need to.
Yeah, at some point, I'm not making a political statement.
Did you want to go first, or do you want to
go ahead, Jamie, and then
go for it. Okay. In terms of the prices coming down, I think that the evidence is very strong that the prices have fallen when companies have had to lower prices because either there was actual competition or there was a threat of competition. I mean, the initial price discounts from the European prices in Africa, I mean, for ACE drugs was pretty minimalist. And for the most part right now, what you see in developing countries is kind of a game of chicken. The country's threatened to issue a compulsory license. And the companies, say, I don't believe you. And then, or keep talking to us, or they get the U.S. Embassy to give them a call or something like that. They try and kind of go back and forth. But before Brazil and Thailand moved, I mean, the Merck prices for stockmen in countries outside of the African market were really, really pretty high. And same with Kaletra. The compulsory licenses there have really dramatically changed those prices. So I think that there's a million data points now that they're a real big impact on prices. It's not a benevolent thing that's happening. I mean, companies are run by businessmen. Generic companies are run by businessmen. So are the big companies, and it is a business. Consumers have to sort of think about what is in their interest to do. As far as the politics of the big pharma companies are concerned, they're pretty powerful, but they're not all powerful. And there's a big difference between having a lot of influence and having kind of unlimited influence. I mean, I'm sure if you talk to Chris, he would tell you that a lot of the big companies are unhappy with the Doha Declaration. They're unhappy with the new White House deal with USTR on rolling back the agreement. They certainly have wanted the USTR to do a lot more than they've done in the Thailand case, as I read the situation. And what groups, what the activists have done, has really been a powerful. I mean, I think, you know, a small number of activists compared to a large number of pharmaceutical lobbyists is actually not as unfair of a fight as you might think. I mean, it is important that people weigh in. I think that if people don't weigh in, I think that it's impossible to really have a huge effect. Sometimes we've been encouraged, and I'm sure others have too, to be active in the thing so that the people that work in the government can do what they think is the right thing. They want us to beat up on them on one side so that they have a little bit more, it doesn't look like they're being heroes on behalf of poor people. They want to look like they're being pressured to help poor people. You know, I sometimes you see that. So I think pressure is a good thing for a lot of reasons. And I think most people that work in government go into public service for the right reasons. And I think that, you know, you see that when you talk to people. It's not just a way shop into a lobby shop for everybody, although it is for some people. But in terms of prizes, it is certainly the case that the objection that companies have, one of the objections of moving from a system of a set of exclusive rights or a monopoly on a drug to a system of prizes, is if you give the governments the freedom to choose what the size of the prize is instead of the companies the freedom to choose as to what the price is in order to get the drug, they think it's going to turn out badly for them. They think that the governments will choose really small prizes. I mean, that's pretty much what it's about. So if you don't have credibility about the size of the funding from an alternative to the monopoly, if you don't have credibility about the sustainability of it, I think it is going to be a huge problem to make a switch from the current system. Now, the proposal on the donor market for PEPFAR and things is to take a fixed fraction of the market and set it aside as prizes, like 10% of drug purchases. I think the interesting thing about that is that the whole existence of the AIDS market in developing countries is essentially about whether donors put money into it. And donors will only put money into it if they think they get enough return in terms of life saved for the amount of money that they put in terms of tax dollars. Because drug purchases compete with investments in roads and schools and other things that donors can do. And so if the companies price their products too high, they actually erode the entire donor market because the donors just walk away from the AIDS market and they put their money into some other good cause. So collectively, the drug companies kind of have an interest in keeping the donors at least feeling like it's worthwhile to spend the money in the area. And if they overreach, it creates a problem. But if they underreach, they get no money. So by fixing and negotiating what fraction of the drug purchases go into the market, what you do is you say, you know, it's tied to how much money we're spending on drugs. And if the amount of money we spend on drugs goes up, you'll get more money. And it's more likely to go up if the prices of the products themselves are closer to marginal cost on the margins. So you've got more life saved for every dollar that you put into it. And if you got a real agreement by donors to fix the portion of PEPFAR and the Global Fund and Unit Aid at something like 10%, which is a little bit more than the global reinvestment in R&D in 2005, what you've done, and you could negotiate a different number if that's what it's about, what you do is you basically say, okay, some amount of money we spend as humanitarians will go to feed the pipeline for new drugs, and let's talk money. Is it 10%, is it 8%, is it 12%? There has to be a number that sort of seems like a reasonable outcome. But you say, because it's a humanitarian effort, we're not going to compromise on whether the products themselves are available at marginal cost. So what you basically say is we'll have marginal cost pricing of the products, but we'll have a guaranteed stream of money to reward innovators. And I think if you introduce it in developing countries as it relates to AIDS treatment and treatment for tuberculosis and malaria, where there's a commitment by donors to sustain treatment, and you're essentially looking where you are the consumer as the federal government in the first place, you create kind of a much better business model for sustaining treatment in AIDS than if you have a $2,000 drug in a portfolio next to a $30 drug and you have complete randomness in terms of drug pricing and completely irrational and harmful prescribing of drugs.
So just to say, I mean, there's a couple of pieces that I would love to address. One is this kind of question of whether or not, generics have made the difference, right? And I mean, I think the evidence, thanks for coming. The evidence is that, you know, prices do fall when there's generic competition. But the question of what's different is what's really important here. And what's different between the first line of therapy and the second line of therapy is actually the introduction of a patent system in India. right? And everybody needs to just understand that as of 2005, there are patents in India, which is in fact the place that serves the world when it comes to making generic AIDS drugs. And so there are a few other really strong markets, but it's Indian generics that are actually making the difference between whether or not it costs $2,000 to keep a person on drugs or whether it costs $150 to keep a person on drugs in Africa and in the Caribbean. So this is really important to understand. And in the World Trade Organization rules, as of 2005, there is now a patent system in India, which means that now flexibilities matter dramatically more than they did before that was in fact the case. And so, you know, we kind of heard that, okay, it was able to be resolved in the first-line therapy. Well, that's true, because what was resolved was there weren't patents, and therefore people were able to make generic AIDS drugs, right? That's no longer the case. And so now we are seeing that actually with the new drugs, there have to be flexibilities. And we're seeing that when companies try to use those flexibilities, they are slapped down. And so most recently, that's been Thailand that said, okay, we are going to issue a compulsory license. They issued a compulsory license on several AIDS drugs and a heart disease drug, right? Now, these were not drugs that were, you know, this is not, you know, the kind of erection pill. This is not, you know, some random drug, right? These are, in fact, the drugs that are affecting people who are, you know, who's dying the most in Thailand. And where, as you look at the Thai government, which has said that, in fact, we're going to set up a system of universal, you know, universal health care and universal access to these drugs if you need them. Well, can we sustain that? And the answer, looking ahead, was no. There's just no way for us to run a system if we're going to have to pay $5,000 per year for every person on AIDS drugs. And therefore, we have to bring down the price. And these folks said to the drug companies, you need to bring down your prices. And the drug companies said, no. So this idea that the drug companies are somehow kind of like, oh, they're being good folks and it's all good, is a bit of a myth, right? That every time we've seen the drug companies bring down their prices, it's because they're worried that somebody's about to create a compulsory license and deprive them of their intellectual property, right? And then what we saw in Thailand was that, in fact, they got slapped down, right? They were put onto a higher watch list. They were threatened with sanctions. It was a very clear ultimatum that was put out there. And then as they've thought about maybe compulsorily licensing more drugs, in fact, we've seen the same thing. So if we had a U.S. policy that were actually about using those flexibilities, what we would have seen out of USTR were letters saying, good job, way to use the World Trade Organization flexibilities in only the ways that are legal. We really appreciate that. Way to go, Thailand. This is, in fact, the opposite of what we saw, right? So this kind of inclination that we're, in fact, trying to expand access to drugs is really a myth, and people just need to understand that that's in fact the case, and then also understand that the new World Trade Organization rules that are saying there have to be patents on pharmaceuticals is also really important. The other thing to just say, backing up a little bit, is that we have to remember that patents were in fact created out of people's minds, right? Nobody, like God did not hand down a patent system that works this way, and that in fact pre-2005, many countries had either, you know, rejected the idea of having patents on life-saving, you know, innovations, or didn't have the same kind of patent system that the US did, right? The expansion of the US model has been because what the US has said is giving countries this kind of horrible bargain, which is either you can adopt our system on patents and give drug companies, but also all sorts of other kinds of companies, the ability to own knowledge, or you can have access to our markets, right? And if that's your choice, if you're like, huh, I wonder if I should let people, you know, deny people access to good jobs, right? Should I, in fact, cripple my economy by deciding to walk away from the U.S. markets, right, and walk away from all of that? Or should I, you know, protect our right to someday eventually be able to kind of own some knowledge? If those are the two options, then it's been really hard for governments to stand up and say, we're going to stand on principle, we're going to stand on a new system, when the immediate implications are really massive. And the entire business community in a country will say, what are you doing? You're going to deprive us of all of our income. How can you do that? You'll cripple us. And then the government gets tossed out of office. This is a really hard piece to kind of, and you were talking about the political realities. This is, in fact, what we're dealing with. And this is why folks in the United States need to be talking about this stuff, because it's not always possible for governments in the Global South to be standing up to these companies. Period.
Any more questions from the audience? Yeah, go ahead.
may be true to some extent, but we see the more important contract with society for getting a patent is putting that science into the public domain. And that's not insignificant. That's how science moves forward. When we were the first to put the protease inhibitor in the public domain in the late 80s, and that led to a race among all drug companies, and a competitor of ours got to the market first, Roche. But the point is that it's putting the information in the public domain that accelerates scientific discovery, and that's the main contract with society. I was troubled, Jamie, because I think you know better to say that the behavior of companies is morally reprehensible. By many, many measures, the U.S.-based pharmaceutical companies are by far the most philanthropic of any sectors. Just as an example, my company, Merck, has been donating as much as needed for river blindness, which is a scourge in Africa and Latin America and Yemen, for more than 20 years. No strings attached. And, you know, as long as that's needed, we're going to donate it. And in addition to that, the concessionary prices of that have been offered on AIDS drugs but other drugs,
investment.
Any response?
A few. I mean, I think I'll let Jamie respond to a bunch of those pieces. But I mean, I think one of the things that it's not tax breaks that are actually the most public funding. It's actually direct public funding into research, right? And that's where the biggest amount of U.S. tax dollars are going. And I'm sure Jamie knows. I listened. It's okay. So I'm sure Jamie knows better the numbers exactly, you know, on this stuff. But, I mean, you know, one of the things that happens is that a lot of money, right, goes into, as it should, a lot of public money goes into developing these drugs, right? And so to say that with that shouldn't come some really serious obligations is just not quite fair, right? So that's one piece that, as we talk about public funding, you know, tax breaks are one of the things, and there's a whole bunch of incentives. But the biggest incentive is, in fact, public funding for research. And the other thing that I would just say is that there are a bunch of, I think, very well-meaning at times, I think less well-meaning at other times, philanthropic efforts. But what's not necessarily what's needed. What's needed is access to these drugs, right? And if we know from the history of AIDS drugs, if we know that what actually brings down the cost of drugs is for there actually to be a generic competitor, then what we need is for drug companies to step up and say, of course we will allow generic companies to sell drugs in the global south where we make very little of our profit anyway. Of course we will. That would be true philanthropy, right? That would be stepping up and saying, I'm taking my responsibility of massive profits really seriously, which is to say that of course I'm not going to enforce my patent in India, because that, in fact, would be really problematic in terms of guaranteeing people access. We know that every single time, and there's, correct me if I'm wrong, but I won't make total statements on this. Every single time that I've ever seen that a drug company has, in fact, decreased their price, when there was generic competition, it turned out that you could make it for cheaper. And of course that's the case because big drug companies aren't set up to do the kinds of things that smaller generic companies are. And that's to be expected. The request is not be competitive with these much smaller, much leaner generic companies that don't have the same overhead costs. That's not the request. The request is, in the global south, let them, in fact, make the drugs because we know they can make them cheaper. And across the board, that's the case. And so why would we not do that? That would be real philanthropy, I think. The other piece to say is that I think this sub-quality argument is really a red herring. And it's one that we hear over and over again. And the reality is that we have high-quality generics. We have them. This is not some sort of crazy, like, oh my God, these crazy people are going to start making drugs and we don't know who they are and they don't have factories and maybe Matt's going to make them in his bathtub, right? This is, in fact, companies that are set up and are, in fact, going through rigorous tests and rigorous processes to make sure that these drugs are, in fact, safe and effective. And, in fact, we've seen through the first generation of AIDS drugs that actually generic companies are perfectly capable of making the exact same drugs and making them for a lot cheaper. So this argument that somehow somebody's trying to willy-nilly say, oh my God, let's get rid of safeguards, isn't true. Because, in fact, there are drug regulatory agencies who are charged with making sure that all of the drugs, not just the brand name drugs, but also the generic drugs, are safe and effective. This would not be affected in the least. We're not getting rid of the FDA. We're not getting rid of the FDA in all these countries. We're getting rid of another system, which is a patent system, which says, in fact, that you're not allowed to make the drugs, right? So these are two really different things. And then finally, just to say on Thailand, the argument that somehow the kind of lower prices are going to be for Africa are going to be affected is just, I would argue, not true, right? Because, A, what we really want is not decreased, you know, drug company pricing. We're glad that that's happening, and we think that it should happen more. But ultimately, what we want is access to generic versions of these drugs, right? Because those are, in fact, where we see the prices come down. But the second piece to say is that in this whole argument of Thailand and this whole argument around kind of whether or not they're allowed to do it is based on the premise that these drug companies will be the only ones who will ever make these drugs. And what we've actually seen is that as soon as Thailand demanded issued a compulsory license, there was instantly a generic market. And instantly a generic came out and within 2 months actually hit the price of Abbott's Kaletra, right? Hit the same price. We're pretty sure that shortly it's going to be lower, right? As soon as they can get increased market share, right? So this happened really quickly. and was a matter of making sure that the compulsory license came out. So this, in fact, if we were being serious about increasing access and increasing drugs into bodies, right, we would be thinking about ways that we actually increase the use of compulsory licenses. Not willy-nilly, not on the, you know, this kind of crazy, you know, system of where, like, every drug will be compulsorily licensed, but on the drugs that matter, whether it's life or death, and we can choose life, of course we should choose life. And of course we should choose the ways in which we get people, poor people, especially in the global south, access to these drugs. That's just really clear to me.
Susan, I didn't see you in the back there. I can't see very well without my glasses. It's nice to see you. When I said that the access problems were morally repugnant, I wasn't really referring to what you personally do or what your company does. I mean, I could talk about what different companies do or some of the things that some people in companies have done, but that's not what I was referring to. I was just talking about the system. The system, I mean, I guess Merck has lobbyists, so part of the system is because of what Merck does. But, I mean, the system is really what we all do. I mean, we have this system of patents, and Merck is just a player in the system. It's a business. It plays by the rules. It doesn't make all the rules itself. So what's morally repugnant is we sort of politically, as a government, and through trade agreements and through WTO and things like that, we say, well, let's have a system where you grant 20-year monopolies on medical inventions and wait for an entire generation before poor people get access to medicine. To me, the system is what's morally repugnant. And if you heard me saying that, you know, your company was morally repugnant, I didn't say that. And I mean, I might someday get up and make a claim against some company someday, but that's not our main interest. It's more interest about kind of the way the system works. And I saw Peter in here, so I assume he wants this out, right? It is expensive to do drug development. It is risky. And if the system you set up to pay for R&D pays nothing, people won't take those risks. So I think it's in everyone's interest to find a way to have innovation. Our point is it's in everybody's interest to have a system that also deals with access. That, you know, you want to think about both, right? So we're willing to say that all the people working on access should have a story about where the innovation comes from. I think that's a good idea. I think everybody that runs a flag up on access for poor people should explain where the money comes from the new drug. And we're happy to do that. And I think everybody should. And I think everybody should also, though, explain where the access comes from. I mean, that's the other part of the equation. And I think that, let's take the idea of Brazil versus Africa on prices. That'd be my last point. And that is that I think Brazil and Africa, and I think Beverly Hills should think about paying the same price for drugs, which is just the cost of making a drug at the end of the day. But I think they should pay different amounts for innovation. I think what you want is you want to have how much you spend for drugs be as low as possible for everyone, so that no person, even a janitor in Beverly Hills or a teacher in Mozambique, that nobody really gets sicker than they have to because they can't pay the cost of making a copy of a drug. On the other hand, I think people that make more money should pay more for the pipeline. I think we should all pay higher amounts of money for innovation. And so what we're looking for is a way where you can separate the market for the product. So that's actually cheap on the margin, but you actually have a differential contributions to the innovation thing so that your employees at Merck have a payday and that they have a good life and they put their kids through private schools like American University and things. But, I mean, that would be good, okay? So I'm on your side in that, on that larger point of of the welfare of the employees of Merck and everything, and maybe differing as to how you get there. The last thing is on and donations that come up a million times. We've actually written a note about this enhanced donation, investigated it about 5 years ago quite a bit. But Merck and Senator Bradley, when he ran for president, actually took credit for putting the enhanced donation into the tax code around the river blindness issue. He was asked by people, AIDS activists, actually, what he'd done, because everybody was wanting to be the good guy versus Gore being the bad guy. But actually, there was nobody that was more pro-pharma than Bill Bradley, the senator from Merck, or they used to call him, the senator from New Jersey. Now, Bill Bradley, what he said is he put the enhanced donation. It's twice the cost of goods to a qualified organization for this enhanced donation that the River Blindness operates under. And most of us believe that the way it's calculated by the companies, it is a fairly profitable thing. And there's an enormous effort to push donations by companies as kind of a model for access. And it's criticized by almost every public health group as being a poor solution to the long-run sustainability. But I certainly think among all the donations programs, most people hold out the River Blindness one to be one of the very best. And that the commitment from Merck has been commendable in that respect, and people are grateful for it.
Great. So thank you very much, and thank you to our panel.